Hello, I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk, coming up.
A doctor is carrying a young boy to his father in Gaza's biggest hospital. He's dead. One of three children killed by shelling from Israeli tanks in the east of Gaza City.
As the bloody conflict in Gaza enters its second week, we discuss the problems of covering the Middle East. Does the British media really have an anti-Israel bias? Also in the podcast, French public TV goes ad-free. We'll analyse the impact of Nicolas Sarkozy's new cultural revolution. And
there's been a break-in at his high school. Type 3, I'd say. Secretary must have disturbed it. Okay, gotta go. Showtime.
That's Philip Glenister in ITV's new primetime show, Demons. We ask, is it the least convincing US accent on the telly? All this and plenty more coming up on Media Talk from The Guardian. It's a new year and a new pod. Happy New Year, by the way. Yes, this is the first time we've recorded our podcast in our lovely new studios in The Guardian's non-ironic new HQ. And if you've got a new iPod for Christmas and you're new to podcasting, welcome to The Guardian's weekly media roundup. You're very welcome to our friendly band. So a smart location, we thought, deserves a smart panel. And we've got two of Media Talk's most sartorially inclined gents here to do the job. Steve Busfield is The Guardian's head of media and technology, a man never knowingly seen without a Hawaiian shirt. What was it that Homer Simpson said about Hawaiian shirts?
They were only worn by gays and big fat party animals.
Well, I think we'll leave the listeners to work out which category you fall into, shall we? Resplendent in pinstripes. Well, you're often resplendent in pinstripes, but you're not quite today. But you are resplendent in Armani glasses, aren't you? Stephen Brook is The Guardian's press and publishing correspondent. It's been a while, Brookie.
It has the bitches back, Matt.
you said it. Gareth McLean will be joining us later on to make it a triumvirate of fashionistas. And with our panel safely in situ, it's time to begin. The news has been dominated for the past 2 weeks or so with the violence in Gaza. For its part, portions of the British media is often accused of being anti-Israel and sometimes anti-Semitic. Stephen Pollard, editor of the Jewish Chronicle, wrote on his blog this week that the BBC is too pro-Palestinian. He even said that some of the observations made by the corporation's Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen could have come straight from Hamas. We'll hear from Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland on that in a moment. First, though, I asked Harriet Sherwood, The Guardian's head of international news, about the decisions and sensitivities that have to be taken into account when covering Israel and the Middle East, as well as the practicalities of reporting in a war zone.
It's been really, really difficult. It's a complete nightmare. The main problem, of course, is that Erez, the crossing into Gaza, has been closed since quite a long time before this conflict began. So no British media reporters in Gaza, and it's been impossible to get in, and this means that we're all having to report by using our fixers and translators there, and it means doing it remotely. Obviously we'd like to be able to see it for ourselves, we'd like to be able to move freely within Gaza, and we can't do any on the ground reporting firsthand ourselves.
The Israeli government has said that this is because of safety reasons. Do you buy that as an explanation?
No, I mean, I think that's part of the explanation, but I think the much more substantial explanation is that they don't want Western media in there, or in fact any media in there, to report what's happening. And the level of destruction and casualties is huge, and it's obviously a very powerful story to be told, and they really don't want it out there.
The Guardian and the BBC and a number of other liberal media outlets are often accused of being biased against the Israeli side. Is that a criticism that you recognise, and do you take account of that sort of criticism in the decisions that you take about coverage and deployment?
Yes, I mean, of course you take it into account because you want to give fair coverage of a conflict and you want to be able to report it from both sides. At the moment we're unable to report it from the Gazan side, and of course, you know, I think that even if we were in Gaza, I think that you still have to look at the kind of balance of equation. There's now more than 700 Palestinians that have been killed in Gaza, many of whom will be militants, and that compares with, I think, 11 or 12 Israelis, of which I think 7 are soldiers. So, I mean, it's completely unbalanced. Now, one of the side effects of not being allowed to report from Gaza is, I think, that the Israeli government hopes that because the instinct of every reporter is to go out and report, is that we'll then start giving much more attention to the Israelis in towns like Sderot and Ashkelon, who, you know, are getting barrages of rockets from Hamas, which is a very important story and needs to be told, and we are telling it. But we can only tell one side of the story, and I think that, you know, that's the kind of critical issue for the media coverage of this conflict.
Harriet Sherwood there in a noisy Guardian newsroom. Well, let's hear now from Jonathan Friedland. In addition to his day job here at The Guardian, he also writes a weekly column for the Jewish Chronicle. I began by asking him whether the JC's editor was justified in criticising the BBC's coverage of Gaza.
I think that's unfair, and I think not only is it unfair, it's sort of out of step with a lot of what pro-Israel people privately, and even some of them publicly, are saying about media coverage or of this conflict. There was a great deal of anxiety in 2006 among pro-Israel folk who felt that the media coverage in Britain was extremely hostile. And what many of them are saying, including the media professionals whose job it is to put Israel's case, is that they feel they've got a much fairer shake this time and that they've been understood much better. Watching the BBC coverage myself, I have to say I've been struck by the repeated inclusion in every report of what is the central part of Israel's case, which is that the reason behind this Gaza operation is that rockets from Hamas were landing on residents of southern Israel. And I think almost every Jeremy Bowen report makes reference to that. And in the Lebanon conflict a couple of years ago, a lot of people felt that side of the argument was missing.
And it's interesting that the appointment, in fact, of Jeremy Bowen as the Middle East editor was the result of an big internal inquiry that went on at the BBC, because there was a feeling really across the board that the BBC's coverage had got it wrong that time round.
There was a huge amount of pressure put on the BBC during the Lebanon conflict in 2006 and afterwards, and they did take it very seriously and did look internally and did make those changes. And the key point, I think, that they've taken away from it is that they really ought to include constantly an explanation for why Israel's doing it. The criticism that even I was sympathetic to in 2006 was, to anybody who hadn't followed it, it looked as if Israel had just kind of gone nuts and was suddenly raining fire on Lebanon for no reason. And yet there had been this rocket fire from Hezbollah onto northern Israel, and that point wasn't made. And I think the BBC now is absolutely bending over backwards to make sure no one can make that criticism of it this time.
What has Israel been doing to influence hostile media, not just the BBC, but all around the world, in the run-up to this conflict?
Well, one of the fascinating things about this conflict is, although on some way the actual immediate moment it struck did come as a surprise, there had been very obvious, very visible preparation for it. And Israel doesn't deny that for about the last 6 months, they were preparing. 8 months ago, they formed a new body called the National Information Directorate, tasked, we now realise, really with public diplomacy, making these kinds of arguments around the world. We know even here at The Guardian, we have been lavished with attention by Israel, where the Prime Minister's spokesman Mark Regev has made frequent visits here and speaks with us, and there have been other Israeli officials, etc., doing that. I slightly wonder if that is, you know, not only because The Guardian has a lot of influence in Britain as a newspaper, but now I think the Israelis have understood that the BBC and The Guardian and others have powerful websites that actually have an impact in the arena that matters most to Israel, which is American public opinion. That Guardian.co.uk is read in the United States, so is the BBC website. And so, interestingly, they would now almost have to view as foreign media. The leading Israeli liberal newspaper, Haaretz, has an extremely well-used website, and that it will be read by Americans, and that suddenly has to become part of the foreign media effort of the Israelis, and I think that's partly why these last few months they've been paying attention to it.
And why is the US media so pro-Israel, uniformly pro-Israel? Because in Britain, there's a range of opinions expressed, aren't there, in the press, but in America it's very one-sided. And is that because of the different political situation there?
It partly is. I mean, people joke about the New York Times because New York City is, you know, a very Jewish city. There's 2 million Jews who live there, and therefore there's always been a historic sympathy and an understanding of Israel. Funnily enough, some of the people who would be very critical of the BBC and of The Guardian, their equivalents, their counterparts, are hugely critical of the New York Times in America, thinking that is, the pro-Hamas paper. I mean, to somebody who's been reading the British media, they would have no idea what they're talking about. They would consider the New York Times extremely sympathetic to Israel, but in the Israeli, in the American context, it's seen sometimes as the opposite. More generally, I think it does reflect something about American politics, that they're partly further away from it, partly some of the sort of myth-making about the conflict, in which one side is seen as the good guy and one of the bad guy, going back to the 1940s, has never really been eroded in the United States sort of discourse. There hasn't been that moment that has happened in Britain for the last three decades, where people have taken a second look at the mythology of plucky Israel as plucky David against the Goliath of the Arab world. Britain and Europe, that's turned round in the last 30 years, so that Israel is seen as the Goliath and the Palestinians as the beleaguered David. That process just hasn't happened in American politics. They're far away from it. There isn't a sort of loud and clear Arab voice in American politics. And you have this huge tens of millions evangelical Christians who believe, for theological religious reasons, that Israel must be allowed essentially to do whatever it likes, because that's part of God's plan for the second coming. And that's just not a political factor in Europe. So all those things together mean there is an absolutely different discourse. And yet, somehow, that kind of wall between the European and British discourse and the American one has been breached by websites like ours and the BBC and Haaretz.com. And I think the pro-Israel professionals have become very alive to that.
Jonathan Friedland there. Stephen Brook, what do you buy this general accusation that the British media is biased against Israel?
It's a fraught area, isn't it? I mean, I would say generally, not even in reference to Israel, that the tradition in the media in Britain is quite a biased one anyway.
To take a view,
and if you're reporting both sides of the story, and US newspapers are criticised for being sanitised and for being quite dull, this issue is a can of worms, and it really depends on who you talk to, because in the New Statesman this week, John Pilger is saying that the BBC is biased, but it's been craven and it's in favour of Israel, because he sees what they're doing is not reporting the story as he sees it, which is a terrible massacre against the Palestinian people.
Steve Busfield, why do you think there's so much interest in how the media covers these sorts of stories?
It's a subject that polarises opinion more than probably anything else. And there are some very powerful lobbying groups. I mean, I know that any time that The Guardian does anything which is construed as being pro-Israeli or pro-Palestinian, and we are nearly always accused of by the opposite sides for almost exactly the same copy, there is an enormous campaign immediately. You know, the Reader's editor says she gets thousands more emails about these subjects than any other. So there are these campaigning and lobbying groups desperate to get their message across, and never the twain shall meet.
Clearly, if you look at The Guardian's commentary website, there's no agreeing among the commenters there. And
An element in this conflict which is different, is that the media does feel they've been excluded, and Harriet was talking about this, from Gaza, which is where the action is happening. And there's some footage of Sky News reporter Dominic Waghorn, who is doing a live piece to camera on the border, and the camera pans round, and there are policemen out of shot waiting, and he says he's about to be moved on. So that not only has the media been excluded from Gaza, but they've all been corralled into a central point, which is apparently on the northern border.
So your point basically is that, far from, as Jonathan Friedland was saying, the Israelis hoping that their exclusion of the foreign media from Gaza would lead them to report more from the Israeli side, it's actually got the media's sort of hackles up, and they're more likely to be anti-Israeli.
There's that point as well, and there's another one that Robert Fisk makes, that if you do that, you exclude the reporters, then in a way you're giving power to the people within Gaza, because it's their version of events that's getting out, and the Western media can't confirm or deny the stories that are coming out.
All right. Well, this topic's bound to get you reacting as well, so do leave your comments on the blog, the usual place at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. And for the latest news and comprehensive analysis of the situation in Gaza, go to guardian.co.uk/Israel. I'm Matt Wells, still to come on Media Talk. Publicité non plus. We'll speak to our Paris correspondent about President Sarkozy's decision to scrap the ads from France's public TV channels. And Gareth McLean will join us to give his verdict on the new floppy-haired Doctor and to round up the rest of the week's TV news. But before we get to all of that, we thought we'd go through a few of the other media stories from this, the first working week of 2009. And there are a lot of press stories around, so we should start with you, Stephen Brooke, as our press correspondent. Now, we touched on the story of the NewsQuest redundancies before Christmas, but this has really got a life of its own now, hasn't it? Particularly in Scotland.
Yeah, it's still happening. And if you talk to people like Andrew Neil, who used to be involved when the Barclays owned newspapers in Scotland, and there was outrage at the Barclays because they owned the Scotsman and they were trying to buy the Herald, he says that if you look at the scale of the cuts that have occurred in NewsQuest in Scotland, he thinks that politicians and the same protesters have been completely supine on this issue, because he's not the only one who thinks that the cuts have become so severe that these newspapers are utterly a shadow of their former selves. At the same time, you're getting the nationals, like the Times, investing more in Scotland and their circulation's growing. You've got to ask what is going to happen.
Mm. And NewsQuest titles, principally the Herald in Scotland, but also their titles around England are suffering as well, and their job cuts around the north of England, and strikes and all sorts of things happening.
Yeah, and of course the media downturn is being blamed as the reason that is necessitating these cuts. But after, I've been doing this for about sort of 3 years now, and you just wonder how low can they go, because every few months it's cut and cut again.
Has the immediate downturn got anything to do with the Times' decision to raise its cover price to 90p, and I guess the similar reasons behind the decision of the New York Times to have ads on its front page for the first time?
Of course, everyone is out for as much revenue as they can get, and if advertising has fallen off a cliff, then cover prices and circulation is one way to do that. And this is such a huge change for the Times. For decades, they've been involved in a price war with the Telegraph, and even when a truce was called on that, they're always 10, 20 pence cheaper than the opposition. Now you've got the main broadsheets all at the same rate, almost, but the Telegraph is then 90p, and the Guardian is 80, but the poor independent's out there on its own on £1.
Well, it can't be far before the rest of the press catches up. Jonathan Ross is back on BBC One, 23rd of January. Steve Busfield, uncontroversial guests, Lee Evans and Stephen Fry, will you be watching?
No. I'll probably get something else to watch, and we'll probably live blog it, and we'll probably, you know, care deeply about it. But I can't say I particularly enjoy Jonathan Ross's show.
It'll be interesting to see how he's going to deal with that in his opening monologue. Would you, if you were his producer, would you be advising him to mention the suspension or steer well clear and pretend it never happened?
Well, he sent out a Twitter feed, didn't he, saying what should I have as my opening track for Back on the Radio? Maybe he should send out a Twitter feed asking what his first words should be when he's on the telly.
Right. Okay.
Look, I think Jonathan Ross has made a career on being confrontational to his guests, and for him to ignore the whole 3 months and the scandal would really be him sort of departing the field of battle, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
He'd look a bit silly.
We should, before we move on, mention the mysterious case of the Sun's Thursday front page. This is UFO crashes into wind farm. All I can say is that Emily Bell couldn't be reached for comment. One other press story, Steve Busfield, that Media Guardian broke on Thursday relates to the Russians coming for... Well, they've come for Chelsea, then most of the Premier League. They're coming for the British media now. Can you explain this story?
Absolutely. After Roman Abramovich takes over West London's most fashionable football club, we've now got the Lebedev family, Alexander and his son Evgeny, who is quite famous among social circles around here, currently dating Jeremy Richards.
Social circles you move in, but not my social circles. Who's he dating?
Jolie Richardson.
Oh, right, okay.
Oh, he was. Who have inquired as to whether they can acquire the Evening Standard. You can imagine why they would think it would be available for sale, given that it's been in the middle of a horrible circulation war and with London Light and the London paper, and its sales have been horribly hit. You can just about, if you look at Lebedev's history, sort of see why he might be interested in it. He's a 49% owner of a Russian newspaper. But the strange thing about this story is the fact that he came. We understand that he came in, and that the Daily Mail and General Trust said that they didn't want to sell. We can't quite work out why they wouldn't want to sell it under the circumstances they're currently in. Beyond the fact that apparently it's Lady Rothermere's favourite newspaper.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen Brook, as Steve Busfield was saying, the Standard, and you've been reporting, the Standard's been on a sticky wicket for some time, hasn't it?
Sun Bingo has a bigger profit than the Standard does.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Lord Rothermere, I met him once, actually. He's one of those guys with plump cheeks that you can just tell he's been cocooned in a life full of privilege.
Port and cheese after dinner.
Well, I'm just thinking what he's done. He's not sold the regional newspapers that was back sort of 2 or 3 years ago when they had an offer on the table but decided that it was a bit much. And with hindsight, clearly would have been a very generous deal. And if he'd acted then, he would look a hero. And now apparently another offer on the table, and he's decided not to sell a loss-making paper that, as Steve said, is being sort of pummeled by a free newspaper war. We've got to wonder whether sentiment has got in the way of something, you know, a hard-headed business deal.
All right. Well, this is a
we could offer an optimistic view, which is that Rothermere believes that regional newspapers have some future in, you know, in
some form at some point.
Exactly, in some sort of digital way. And, you know, maybe you'll be a hero to the media industry.
Hero of the hour. Well, this is a developing story, and you can find out, keep up to date with updates on that and links to all the other stories we've just been discussing at mediaguardian.co.uk.
Media talk from guardian.co.uk.
Vive la Révolution! Nicolas Sarkozy's controversial cultural revolution of France's television industry began this week. The French president and supermodel Pothereau decreed that public channels in France scrap their ads during the evening peak programming. It's led to heated debates in Parliament and strike action from angered journalists. Well, it's France, after all. Sarkozy called his plans to transform France's public TV channels the Big Bang, but critics have likened him to Italy's Silvio Berlusconi, who's kept a near dictatorial grasp over his nation's airwaves. So just exactly what's going on here, I spoke to our Paris correspondent, Angelique Chrysippus, to find out more.
Nicolas Sarkozy, of course, is known as the telepresident for his obsession with TV. He loves his own ratings. He wishes he had been a TV executive. So going back a year, he announced a cultural revolution for television, which would begin this month, right now as we speak. Now, the first step has been banning advertising from state television at prime time. And if you think that 40% of French people have dinner while watching the TV news at 8 p.m, this is actually a massive step.
In Britain, there would be an outcry if they put advertising on public television. But in France, it's sort of been the other way around, hasn't it? There's been an outcry that they've taken the ads off.
It's very interesting. If you look at Nicolas Sarkozy's rationale here, journalists are actually up in arms, and they've been striking this week, and there have been sporadic strikes and demonstrations over the last few months. Nicolas Sarkozy says this. He says, OK, what I want to do is I want to free the public service in France from advertising wars, from the idea that they have to be constantly chasing ads, and this will make them more creative and public service-minded. Now, France has 5 state television channels. The most watched channel in France is the private station TF1, which is owned by Nicolas Sarkozy's best friend. Now, the argument that many journalists are making is that, OK, if you're going to scrap advertising, how on earth are you going to fund our 5 channels? Now, the licence fee in France is much lower than the licence fee in Britain. There are a couple of issues here. One of them is what will happen to all this advertising, and of course that could benefit TF1, the French private TV channel owned by Nicolas Sarkozy's best friend. But the other crucial issue is how will public service television be funded? And is Nicolas Sarkozy, who's being accused of being a bit of a Berlusconi character, is he actually trying to wrestle control of state television?
There's another issue here in that as part of these reforms, President Sarkozy has taken on himself the responsibility for appointing French public television executives, hasn't he?
Now, that's exactly the case. Now, if we go back a little bit, I'll give you an impression of how important this is in France. In the post-war era under Charles de Gaulle, of course, the state hugely controlled television in France, and this erupted during the May 68 riots, which were really repressed from TV reporting. And we saw journalists take to the streets demanding their independence. Over the successive decades, French TV has managed to sort of try and extricate itself from the state. But the argument is, if you don't have a strong license fee now in France, if you cut advertising from state TV, they simply won't have any money. And they're going to have to go cap in hand all the time to the government. Now, Nicolas Sarkozy answers this by saying, well, he's going to provide funding by a new tax on mobile phone and internet providers. Some people would say that's a strange sector to be taxing at the moment, given that it's really booming. And he's also going to increase tax on ads that are on private channels. But journalists are really concerned, especially with the fact that he now is going to appoint the head of state TV himself. And they're really saying this is a massive step backwards, and this is taking away our right to run our own programming. The other thing that's very interesting from a British point of view is the argument about what Nicolas Sarkozy believes should be on television. If we take away the ads, what would he like to see on these state TV channels? And one of the strange ideas that was mooted a few months ago was he wanted to see more theatre on television, i.e. plonking a TV crew in front of a stage in the theatre and putting that out on primetime TV, which obviously many journalists here were saying, well, that's not the greatest TV we could be producing.
Angelique Christopher speaking from Paris there. Well, you can read more about this story at guardian.co.uk/television. And speaking of which, Gareth McLean is next. The Guardian's TV writer Gareth McLean is here. Gareth,
hello.
How are you? Did you have a good Christmas and New Year?
No.
No. Well, what
yeah,
about...
No, I did, actually.
Let's gloss over that. There's only we obviously have to start with the news of the century, which is Doctor Who.
Yes, Matt Smith.
What do you make...
Party Animals.
Do you know him personally?
I do know him personally, no.
Good appointment?
I think it's a good choice, yeah. And I would sort of, you know, one would trust Stephen Moffat's judgment on these things. I don't think his age is a problem.
Well, a lot of people say he's too young and too pretty.
Well, no. I think there's a certain otherworldliness about him. He's got a bit of a twinkle in his eye. As Andy Buchan, his co-star in Party Animals, said.
But yeah, because you wrote about this.
I did. Yeah. I did. Party Animals is a springboard show.
Yeah, this was the, for people who didn't see that, it was a political show about
BBC Two
researchers in the Labour Party, and he played one of them.
And the Tories as well. Yeah, it was a sort of... It was called This Life Meets the Thick of It, which I'm sure isn't quite true. But it was good. It was good. And, of course, Andrea Riseborough, who went on to The Devil's Whore, and Margaret Thatcher, The Long Watch Finchley, was in it, and Shelley Conn from Mistresses, Andrew Buchan, who's the lead in The Fixer, and, of course, Matt Smith.
Spawned a lot of good talent. So it would suggest, Stephen Brook, that he's going to be pretty good. What do you think?
I thought it was a fantastic unveiling on that Doctor Who Confidential programme.
I thought it was a bit rubbish, actually. Because he just suddenly appeared on the television.
That was the brilliant moment. Who is that person? And then he says, when I was chosen as a doctor, it's like... Who are you? Because the caption didn't actually appear for what seemed like an incredibly long time. Yeah. It's like this person, but I know nothing about him. But I was just struck by something. I thought, yes, this is going to work well.
Long spindly fingers.
He did actually, and you can tell that that's going to become a bit of a trademark. The age thing.
There's no way to talk about Jane Tranter. She did. I mean, God love her, but she looked like she'd been dipped in Vaseline. She was so shiny.
I have to say, nobody came out of that looking very good.
Is literally. That a terrible thing to say?
It was obviously hastily filmed over the Christmas season, I think, and everyone had let themselves go.
Yeah.
But on the age thing, Peter Davison was, 29 when
29.
He took up the role, and by the time Matt Smith gets on TV, he'll probably be 27, and I don't think that's really going to be much of a problem, is it?
No. What about the
especially with Jimmy Savile as his companion?
What?
Jimmy Savile as his companion.
I think that's highly unlikely, isn't it? Steve Russell, do you have anything to say on the new Doctor Who? No. Okay. You might have something to say about Philip Glenister. Is this the worst American accent that's ever been seen on British television? Why did Philip Glenister... I'm getting so uptight and angry that I haven't explained the story. This is Demons, the new sci-fi show on ITV1 on Saturday evenings. He is playing an American for some inexplicable reason.
Yes. Don't look at me.
why is it, Gareth?
I don't know.
Is it your fault?
Well, I think it's maybe just to distract from the general appallingness of the script.
Everyone says it's really bad, but...
I thought it was fine. I thought it was mildly diverting, and it was Saturday night.
It's incredibly derivative, which...
That is true, yes. But then so much of TV now, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I thought I watched it, and it sort of gave me nightmares. I did have like bad dreams after.
It was
watched
a very effective little goblin that kept scurrying around people's apartments,
well,
didn't it?
If anyone knows about effective goblin, it's you, Stephen.
I've been having bad dreams, but it's involved some Guardian staff, and I shouldn't really talk about it in public. It did involve one member of Guardian staff falling from a great height. So I shan't say
from the new building?
No, it wasn't from the new building. It was actually in my old flat for some reason.
Dr. Freud will see you now.
you've been blogging about... You've been very angry, Gareth, this week about...
Very angry.
Linda LaPlante.
Oh, did anyone see it? Well, obviously some people did. 7 million people.
Yeah, yeah. 7.9 million or something.
Yeah, something ridiculous.
And then the second episode, more people watched than the first one.
It was...
You can't say that about many shows.
No, you can't, but it was absolutely dreadful.
What's your problem with Linda LaPlante?
Lurid, lazy and lame. My problem is that she's been churning out the same old rubbish since Prime Suspect.
It's the same story, basically, isn't it? Just in a slightly more gory form every time.
Yeah, and it was just appalling from start to finish.
Thank you. Steve Busfield, have you been watching Celebrity Big Brother?
No.
See, do you watch any television?
I watch FX, I watch The Wire, I watch Underbelly. I'm going to be watching Generation Kill.
Actually, can I just say, on Celebrity Big Brother, I haven't been watching it either.
Okay.
But there is a hilarious...
But you do have an opinion on it.
Bizarre. There's a clip of Ulrika and Vern doing Diana Ross and Lionel Richie, Endless Love. That penetrated your conscience, doesn't it?
No, it hasn't. Yeah.
You might have an opinion, Steve Busfield, on the last ever season of ER.
I'm very excited about the last ever season.
Because you hate
it? No, I love it. I think, you know, I mean, I think it's not as innovative and exciting as it was in the early days. I think they've lost something with all of the original cast.
Well, they all left, gone. Didn't they?
But they've
been going for so long.
Yeah, and the people and most Corey. Of the people who are in the sort of central roles now have been doing it for 6, 7, 8, 9 seasons. Mm. So actually, you know, they started off as sort of smaller characters. Mm. And they've dealt with some fantastic issues and done some great storylines over the last few years. Plus, I'm one of the people who thinks that the two Romano helicopter incidents, you know, were fantastic television as opposed to the moment that the show jumped the shark.
I have never watched a single episode of ER.
And you're showing off about that, are you? I didn't realise it was still on.
Well, yes, it still is. Well, it's not anymore. Well, they're just coming to the last one.
Yeah, no, well, they're hiding on more 4 as well.
I do know now. Oh, yeah, another brilliant decision from Channel 4. Well done, boys.
Well, anyway, thank you very much. Thank you for your advice for Channel 4. Thank you to...
you're welcome. I have more. I'm planning to do a big blog about Channel 4 next week.
Oh, really? Well, we should look forward to that. Thank you very much, Gareth McLean, and also to the two Steves, Stephen Brook and Steve Busfield, for kicking off Media Talk 2009 in such style. If you want to give us your...
Such style.
That's what it says here.
I'm so glad this is audio.
if you want to give us your feedback on anything we've discussed, post a comment on the blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk or head to the Facebook group. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. See you again soon.